Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is April 28th, 2017. We are coming to you live from Lobby One. Woo! This is Waypoint Radio. It's spring outside.
Yeah.
In New York City.
They're here.
They're drilling.
They are.
Probably for more spring. They're like, oh, this is good. We've got to keep digging for it.
Drilling for your spring.
But I think they may have hit our internet because our internet dipped once earlier. Okay. So we could drop again if you're watching us live on Twitch because they're coming for us. They're coming for our internet. They don't want you to hear this pod.
Yeah, this is like Waypoint Pirate Radio.
Waypoint Pirate Radio.
Yeah.
Welcome. WPPR.
We should make pirate noises then.
That was my like internet pirate
PPR.
Noise. All right. Rob Zachney's with us.
Hey, what's up? I'm not sure either of you guys know what pirate radio is, but I appreciate the thought.
That's the sound that internet pirates make. Patrick Klefik joining us also.
I'm here. I'm shielding my eyes.
Good.
Same, always. Let's just do this.
We should have
cosplayed as our favorite Nier characters, Patrick. We just put on the blindfolds. We have a Nier spoiler cast coming to you this weekend, tomorrow. Our special guest, I'll say now, I think people figured it out, is Alex Navarro from Giant Bomb. And then the pun queen herself.
I'm the pun queen myself. Danielle
Riendo. Thanks. Joining us on this beautiful spring day. We're going to talk about video games.
Yeah.
We all played video games this week. Sometimes we get to Friday and it's like, what did you guys do? Oh, meetings. Everybody did meetings this week.
We did meetings and edits.
And edits.
And like invoice processing.
And then this week what we did instead was, what if we played video games?
Yeah, it was great.
Patrick, what have you been up to? What have you been playing?
It's video game week at Waypoint.
At Waypoint, yeah. We got a theme week coming. I'm going to run this up to sales real quick and see if they can do anything with this theme week.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, we're doing a week about this little thing called video games.
Interactive media.
Could you guys go to like a like candy company or somebody who makes hamburgers and sell that, maybe?
Yeah, pretty much.
Video games.
Sick burn.
Play
right
them. Patrick, what have you been playing?
Well, I literally, just before we started this podcast this morning, I sat down and finished... Was it What Remains of Edith Finch? Is that the title? I know Edith Finch. That's the full
title,
right?
What Remains?
What Remains? What Remained?
I believe so.
What Remains?
What Remains?
Yeah.
I'm looking at Steam. What Remains of Edith Finch? That is correct.
No question mark. Just a sentence.
Right.
What Remains.
Right.
I guess it could be interpreted both ways.
Sure. In my mind, when I was playing it, I was thinking it was called The Remains of Edith Finch, which is a different...
it's a darker game,
yeah, it's more and more... Yeah. Well... It's a fairly morbid game to begin with, although that title would imply that title would
body
have still
parts
been
everywhere. Yeah,
totally
accurate. Yeah. So we talked about this game right after PAX East because I played it there at the Annapurna booth. Annapurna is the publisher. It seems like they're publishing a bunch of cool stuff right now. So I gave the setup there, but I'll give a really brief one because I also played it this week. What Remains of Edith Finch is a game in which you are playing as a character named Edith, who is returning to her childhood home, which is this strange kind of like magical, very like young adult magical realism styles, right? Like kind of like it feels like a Lemony Snicket's or a Dr. Seuss almost, like houses on top of houses spiraling up into the sky.
Lemony Snicket is a good, I think, touchdown for that because Lemony Snicket has sort of a – not snarky, but like it's not even dark, but it's like, you know, like Tim Burton light sort of tone.
Yeah,
totally. And you're going there. It's the first time you've been back since your family moved out after your brother died. And you know that in the first like 5 minutes. And you're there to kind of figure out the mystery of your family, of the Finches. And, you know, you go and you hit the pause button and you see a family tree with all these different characters or names, right? Like, oh, here's Lewis, here's Sam, here's all of your family members. And the game is an anthology, basically, in which you explore the house and then find something in throughout all the rooms of the house that communicate to you through an interactive experience what happened with the characters, who they were, and then how they died. That's like the very bare bones pitch.
Yeah, there's like a family curse, it's pitched that way as like if you're a Finch, then you live until you die in a way that is a little different than
what a crazy
the process
family.
Of most other people. Yeah,
gotcha.
You live until you die. You know what I'm saying?
You live until you die. So the big question I think that I have about this game is, so it's a story, huh?
Well,
so there's a story in this video game.
It was a charged question this week.
I know.
Danielle, what are you getting at?
I'm getting at, does this relate in some way to the fiery piece that went up? Let's go to a fiery piece that went up from a certain...
not a hot take.
Not a hot take, a fiery piece. It's an alternative to a hot take. And what if Ian Bogost wrote about story in games and how it often falls short, and then took a poop on young adult literature, which you also referenced in
well,
there.
Well, so. I didn't even mean to do that. That wasn't even an intentional connection at that time. The story also does just remind me of young adult fiction, like, which is not a diss at Edith Finch.
That's the thing.
I think there's a big conversation that'd be had about story in games.
Yeah. Which both you and Patrick wrote about.
We did. But I almost want to like.
I think let's start with this game though.
Let's start with this game.
Right. Let's tease out more of this game. You know, I think if people have, if you know this game follows in the vein of Gone Home. You know, it's yeah, you know, a walking simulator to you know use a not even a pejorative at this point. Like it's been owned enough that it's just you kind of know what you're in for with one of these types of games. It's like light interactions. Although I'd argue this game goes out of its way to. You know, you're essentially the way the game is set up is it very cleverly is displaying dialogue in front of you. Like you have this book with you at all times that gives you a sense of the family tree, and then there's this text in front of you that is contextualized in the world. Like it'll like the dialogue will be alongside something that you should go investigate, or it's leading you towards the path that's next, or if there's wind in the area, like it will kind of float with the wind. Like the game does some interesting ways of trying to impose the storytelling on the environment in a way that is sort of evolving something that was begun with games like Gone Home and Dear Esther. And furthermore, like the actual sequences that you're going through, like the way it often works is that you encounter someone in the family tree's like room or some sort of something that they own, something that represents them. There's some sort of letter or poem or something left behind that tells a story. And in a lot of games, if I was like to transplant this to Gone Home, you would pick that up, you would read the text, and then you would move on. And so what Edith Finch does is tries to visualize and present what is present in a lot of these games, which are like diary entries, and visualizes them and makes them something you interact with on not a really like consequential level, but like just enough that you feel like you're, you know, like for instance, one has you transforming into an animal and like a cat that's like jumping through trees, or another one where
I said that one a couple weeks ago. I don't want to like
that's really cool.
There's definitely a thing here. It's like I don't want to spoil them,
right?
But so if you want to hear about one, you can go back to the episode that was right after PAX East when I talked about What Remains of Edith Finch, because I give a pretty good rundown of the first one of those in the game. But one of the things that's interesting for me, Patrick, is often it's not just representing what the letter or whatever it is, right? Like you'll find a poem and the poem will be about a thing, or you'll find a letter and the letter will be about a thing, or you'll find some legal documents. And what's represented is often like two steps removed. So you'll find a legal document about an event and a letter attached or whatever. And then what you will see will not necessarily be the thing that's depicted in the event. It will be the catalyst that leads to that letter. And even that event will then be seen through the lens of the imagination of one of the characters.
Who's
kind of like putting them, you know, understanding the event in this way that you don't always know if it's there's like multiple levels of an untrustworthy narrator, right? Where you're like, okay, is something really magical happening here, or is this like materially the thing that happened? When we talk about having a cursed family, like what do we mean? And I think it often is really surprising in some really cool ways. Like a lot of these little mini vignette, like interactive moments are do really clever things with controls. Mike Diver wrote a piece about this game for us in which he basically says, like, this is one of those great examples of a game in which the mechanics help deliver the story, and that the story would not be so effective if it weren't for the level of interaction that you have with it, even though it's also an incredibly linear game.
And it does really smart things with changing, you know, without getting into what it actually does, like it changes like visual aesthetics in like radical ways and presentation in radical ways. Like the game is largely presented as a first person. You look around and you hit a right button to interact with an object. But, you know, without getting into exactly how it changes things, like there are like radical shifts in the way it presents different narratives that are like could only like you could present it in different mediums, and maybe this, you know, gives us a tangent to talk about some of the other stuff this week. But the nature of like you interacting with it like makes it imbues it with more meaning in a way that I really enjoyed. And also, like, without explicitly saying what it is, I did not expect to play Edith Finch, a game that is like pretty somber and quirky, to have like one of the most iconic horror movie soundtracks of all time just suddenly show up. What is not going to say? Not going to say anything.
Let's not talk about it. But what did
I just
want to
say, it's the level of surprise, that kind of surprise where it just the game takes a left turn.
Yep.
And commits and it works. Is present in all sorts of different ways in the game. Like it really commits to like okay. If the base idea of these games is your first person looking around, what else can we do with that? And I think part of the fact that it's as short as it is a
it's like 2 hour game,
at most, depending
You'll
on
blow
how
through it.
But it takes that that you know movie length 2 hour burden and says okay, let's do something a little bit more than what's done in the past. It really takes visual storytelling seriously and tries to be inventive with it in a way that some are more successful than others, but taken as a whole, all those vignettes, I appreciated how striking and like different each of them were and how much they tried to take that individual story and give it a visual metaphor or visual interpretation that aided it. Like if you just read it, it might still have been powerful and interesting, but it was a lot more powerful and interesting through the visual storytelling and aids.
I am like so torn on this game because I think everything you're saying is I think I agree with most of what you're saying here, which is that like it uses the mechanics of it uses interaction, the sort of interaction that happens inside of games, to great effect or to clever effect.
Mm-hmm.
But I rarely felt punched. Mm-hmm. I rarely felt moved. There are moments. There are moments that I'm like, oh, this fucking blows. This is
There's one in particular.
Yeah.
That,
there's that's
like there's
shitty.
One.
There's like actually, yeah. I think it's a chain. I think there's a three-step thing. There's like the relationship of a single character to two other characters in his life, and that chain, or three other characters in his life, really that is really strong and like and encapsulated and would have made this morning. Someone in chat, I think it was Joel in our Discord chat, was like, "What Remains of Edith Finch sounds like a Netflix original drama," and that like three part chain would have been a great episode of a Netflix original drama about that one, or a great like mini arc about this character named Sam and the relationships that he has with other people. But I never, outside of one part of that chain or two parts of that chain, I never like left going like, oh, like I never had that moment that great fiction often gives me, which is I need to go for a walk, right? Like I need to go decompress, or like, oh, this linked back around and grabbed something that it set up, you know, an hour and a half ago, and now I feel like it pulled this hook that it had in me, and I didn't know it had placed that hook, and now I'm hooked, and like, whoa, I lose myself. Like, great fiction devastates me. Even when it's beautiful and optimistic, it, like, changes a day for me.
Yeah.
It changes a week for me. Like, I'll everything about my life, like, shifts when I hit a piece of incredible fiction. And so the thing that is kind of killing me about what Remains with Edith Finch is I think it's an incredible piece of craftwork. I think it's an incredible piece of artwork. I think it's like well done, but it never left me like that. And especially, I think that it has a kind of a pacing issue in the final third, which I don't want to really get into, in which I thought there was not even more answers or something like that. I don't want to get into specifics here, but that it didn't stick its landing in a way that the sort of material, the sort of artistic works that it kind of reflects or that it aspires to be in place with, the best versions of those things do stick their landings in a way that, like, I would have come in here today, like, bubbling to talk about this game. Like, I need to I can't talk about the ending, but I need to, I just didn't have that here. And I think that, to me, ends up complicating this entire debate this week around story in games.
Sure.
Patrick, you wrote a piece. I'm sorry to just keep going back and forth with Patrick, but, like, I want to get into this deeper story conversation.
Yeah, please.
So can you set up the Ian Bogost piece and kind of the conversations that blew up around that?
Yeah, he published a piece on Monday in the Atlantic I'm not sure even how many people read the story as much as just saw the, the headline, as is the case with many things on the internet. The headline was that video games don't need stories and uses what remains of Edith Finch to essentially argue that games are chasing, you know, a traditional Hollywood style form of storytelling that is undercuts what games are best at, or the forms of storytelling that games can be best at. And this set off a whole chain of a lot of anxious narrative game designers on Twitter.
Yep.
It set off a whole chain of people who enjoy the types of games that Ian was critiquing, like Edith Finch or Gone Home, I think his piece is less harsh than the headline, but I would also imagine that that Ian would stand by that because, you know, this is the same person who wrote who's an academic. And also, he's an academic. Like, his writing style is, like, purposely condescending is, I think, what it sounds to, like, the average person.
Right. Like when I published a response piece, and, like, when he retweeted it, it was basically a sort of, like, I don't remember exactly what he wrote, but it was basically, like, an image of him steepling his fingers as if, like, oh, yes, I've pushed the world into discourse. Like, I've made people talk about this thing. He's always struck me as a bit of a gadfly and a bit of a, like, he's here to, like, bite your ass so that you respond.
Yeah.
And that
it's a teaching style.
Yeah, and it's not my favorite one. I don't know.
Me either.
Ian Bogost, I would not be here if not for reading stuff that Ian wrote a decade
Unit
ago.
Unit Operations.
Right, Unit Operations specifically, Persuasive Games also. I wrote this week and I did a video on Flower, Sun, and Rain. It was a Suda51 directed game, and said that, like, that's the game that got me back into writing about video games after taking, like, a year and a half off. When I went to write about that game, where I went to try to understand it was Unit Operations, a book by Bogost that helped me find the grammar I needed to dig into games and understand them thematically and, like, in terms of what they're actually doing as games. So, like, lots of respect for that dude. Also, at the end of that piece, he argues, like, the only way for games to become the medium of a generation is for them to stop aspiring to include narrative. And, like, that's not the most productive argument you could make.
Yeah, and you know, the argument I made in my piece was that even if that's true, right, if we, like, fast forward 300 years from now and, you know, video game narrative designers determine, actually, yes, video games as a medium are fundamentally flawed in this sort of narrative storytelling. Like, the argument I made was, like, well, we don't have a choice here. Like, video games are an increasingly and already are, like, a medium of choice, whether you want to define it as for a generation or whatever the case. It is a important medium in which people love video games, people love stories, and people have shown that they love video games telling stories. And so video games don't have a choice but to approach that problem from different, vantage points, different perspectives,
right,
and to see where that takes them. And that's why I like the quote from Charles Pratt that I have in my article. He's like, well, music and opera are both flawed ways to tell stories, but they're still interesting mediums to tell stories. And I thought that that's a perfect analog. Is like, lots of mediums may tell stories that would be better, quote-unquote, stories, whatever that means, if, like, written down in a book or said in a poem. But if, you know, the artists that exist that want to create in that medium and the people that, prefer or enjoy that medium, they look for stories too. And so as a result of that, video games will and must tell stories. And then the responsibility is for video games to figure out how to do that.
Totally. Rob, you're someone who plays lots of games that are about history and about historical narratives. Those are stories you've heard a billion times, whether they're true or false, or whether they're true or fiction. You've played games about the storming of the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, and also have read great historical accounts of that event and of a billion other events. But also the thing that's interesting to me about the games that, you know, you write about and talk about and podcast about is that they don't have traditional stories. How did this argument strike you? Like, they don't necessarily have the, oh, and then there's this character who we follow through their events through the war necessarily. And Bagost strikes me as appealing to the sort of player like you who likes those sorts of games that aren't necessarily narrative focused. How did his argument strike you, and do you think there's any connection there?
So let me tackle like just how it struck me first, and sort of the motivations Please. That go into playing some of these like history simulators, I guess we could call them.
Sure.
There is, like, if your only understanding of history comes from the games people make about history, you're not going to have a very good understanding of history. like, you're going to come away pretty convinced that, like, Confederates and Nazis were both, like, fucking awesome soldiers. And it's a damn shame that they got overwhelmed in the end. But
yep.
I think the other thing, though, is that when you do come to it with the context of what it's sort of trying to model and simulate, there is still something qualitatively different about the experience than of exploring the same space that you've read about. I can read really tremendous books on the Battle of Gettysburg, right?
Right.
But when I'm playing Scourge of War Gettysburg, which is this game that sort of tries to put you not in command of the whole army, but in command of, like, subunits within the army. You're not Robert E. Lee. You're, like, two rungs down from Robert E. Lee. And so you're playing the small corner of a much bigger battle. And this has happened to me. There's this one moment in particular on the first day of Gettysburg. I'm playing this Union brigade that arrives in the second wave to sort of resist the Confederates. And I'm doing really well. And I've really, like, cleared my sector. I'm kicking ass. And I turn around, and I pan the camera to the left, and there's all these blue soldiers, like, just running like hell. And then I turn the camera to the right, and there's no, but there was a Union, there's a Union army to my right there a second ago, and now they're just gone. And there's, like, Confederates coming down the road. That isn't an experience you're really going to get from reading a book, but it's a fundamental one to what it was like to sort of, like, command in those, to what it was like to be on those battlefields, right?
Where there is not, to unpack that a little bit, like, for a commander at that time, you didn't have a total understanding of what was happening at the more zoomed out level of the war. Like, you didn't know, you knew the units you were commanding. You didn't know what was happening a mile away. A mile is a far distance away, and there's no radio communication.
You knew what you saw, and
let alone
what,
anything more advanced than that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like you could see, and you could have dispatch riders come, but you're not going to get that from reading a book, because a book, you're still going to read about it, and then you're going to see a map, and the map is going to imprint this idea of the thing being readable and under control to its participants in a way that is completely false. But you live through that in a game, and suddenly the experience becomes comprehensible and relatable in a way that it wasn't before. And I think games that let us explore just about anything have that ability to, that in the act of exploring something, in the act of living through some sort of facsimile of something, it does offer us a different relationship that is valuable regardless of whether or not the story is told better or worse.
Well, so, like, that's the sort of argument you're making, or the sort of experience you just relayed, is what I think Bagost does want games to do, right? He does see that sort of moment as leaning into the unique qualities of gameplay. Of the kind of argument he puts together in this piece is that what games do is they take apart things and put them back together. Games are acts of reconfiguration. Like, that's that's not a new concept inside of the field of game studies. It's like, oh, what games do is that they reconfigure things. Everything's about configuration. Everything's from your interaction with a controller to, like, leveling up in a class in an RPG.
Or taking systems out of the context of a wider world so they're actually understandable.
Totally, yeah. Right. And so, like, I guess I want to make sure that to people who are listening who haven't read these pieces, we're not misrepresenting his position. He doesn't think that, like, people who tell emergent stories in games are bad, or that, like, all games should be like red and blue pieces on a board. You know what I mean? Like, I think he does want there to be
experiential storytelling,
exactly, but doesn't want the sort of Edith Finch
linear narratives, right, beginning, aspire, middle, and end.
That come out of a sort of aspiration to be like film or literature, right, or something like that.
He and
like
even acknowledges in the piece that Edith Finch is like a very like an excellent version of these types of games. Like he's like, this is a really well done version of this. I still, he's like, I don't necessarily want this to exist, but it's a good version of a thing I don't like.
Yep. And that's such a tricky thing. And the thing with Edith Finch, the thing that's difficult for me, especially like thinking about the last few weeks of conversations we've been having about Stellaris, about like we're doing the permadeath streams, yeah, which are all about bringing your own, finding your own narrative through systems like clashing against each other. It would have been so easy or better. It would have been so much better for me and like this position that I have, which is, we didn't really get into what I wrote, which was basically like very similar to the Charles Pratt thing, which is like, no, people are going to tell stories. Sorry, bud. People are going to tell stories. That's the reality of it. The reality of it is people tell stories. There's not – we don't – people are going to tell stories. They're going to do it.
Yeah, those teens are going to have sex.
They're going to have sex. Teens
we might as well – we should give them the equipment and the tools to do it
we should pretend there's a world in which teens aren't going to have sex and then talk about it. Right. Those are the two things.
Yes.
Teen sex, death, taxes, teens talking about death, sex, and taxes.
Stories. Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
Teens love taxes.
Teens love taxes. I mean, hashtag teens love taxes.
Austin, there was like there was an interesting point that you made when we were discussing this, and as you were like formulating your idea for your piece, was like, and how much like story and characters imbue motivation for players, right, to interact with, right, systems. And like the one that you mentioned that stuck with me was like Halo, right? Like Halo is like defining characteristic, other than having like really good like left trigger, right trigger shooting, is,
right, well,
like, only, the way, yeah, it revolutionized, yeah, like artificial intelligence or our interactions, yes, with artificial intelligence. Like, and the reason that's interesting is because of the context, story, and motivations for you to interact, right, with that. You can appreciate that artificial intelligence, you know, separate when you go back and think about the individual.
Oh wow,
narrative.
That gunfight! Oh wow, the elites moved around, exactly, in an interesting way, and they flanked me. That was the first time I've ever felt like that.
And I have a million stories of like, you know, me playing like Halo Combat Evolved like solo on Legendary when I had, yeah, hours to commit to that, and like I don't remember those stories now, but I had a million stories that were built out of like those amazing combat encounters I had. But like, you know, if you were to break that down into wireframes and little things running around, like while it is technically the same thing, I don't have the emotional motivation to want to interact with the systems. And so, like,
right,
story imbues systems with purpose for the player. And I think that's also a like separate important like reason for storytelling, is for you to,
totally,
appreciate systems.
Yeah.
So that ends up being the thing that the case that I make is like, instead of asking why are stories a problem for games? I flip it and say like, hey, what problems does including a story solve? And for players, it's like,
yes,
oh, right, Master Chief. I get to be Master Chief. That's who I am. I'm not a gray box with a gun. I'm not even just a space marine, which I don't think the Ghost would have a problem with like a loose theme like dropping on. I'm Master Chief and Cortana is going rampant and I need to get to the end of this thing and I need to stop the flood. And like, it papers over a lot of the bits that like maybe would seem like rough edges. It makes you say like, oh, well, of course I can only hold two guns even though I'm the master. This is just the way it works. This is just the way it works.
That's how it is.
This is the world. I'm so bought into this world. And then it also does something for designers, which is like, it can encourage a certain style of design or like a fictional world or
and
a story.
And encouraging role play in certain ways as well.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then the big one that I only talk about briefly is like, yo, if you're a publisher, it's way easier to sell Master Chief, way easier than like a soldier, right? Or then
or like wireframe arm
totally,
gun.
Totally, but even
that's
just,
all it
just
is. Wireframe arm gun shoots.
Right.
Other wireframes.
But even look at like Medal of Honor when they tried to do that re-release where it was all about what was their freight? Like tier one operatives.
Oh,
or
like,
whatever.
Oh, that was real
God.
Good.
Right, like guy with a huge beard. Like that's them,
yeah,
looking for story so that they can sell their fucking game. Because otherwise it's just another game where you shoot brown folk. And like they needed to differentiate a little bit, just a little bit. And so like, oh, we need characters. We need a story about a guy who's going to pray at a – that was actually Call of Duty, wasn't it? Was Press Square to –
yes.
To give. But you know, those things exist,
oh, yeah,
for lots of reasons, because people want to tell stories, because companies know that there's an audience who will buy stories and who are used to consuming media that has narrative in it. Obviously, there are players, and I think, Rob, you and I can speak to that as people who play strategy games, and you as someone who follows esports, where like, no, what I'm really into is this mechanical interaction and competition and like who wins and who loses stuff. But like, all of this is to say, I wanted to come in here today and be like, that fucking Ian Bogost guy, he played Edith Finch. He can tell that stories are the best things in the world. Fuck off. Ah. But I can't do that because I like Edith Finch. I'm like way more mild on it than I wanted.
Okay, but I want to like say, like, it tells like an interesting, touching, like two, like in and out 2 hours. Like, I also don't want like you to like.
I don't think I was.
I don't
touched.
Want the takeaway for some people to be that like, well, because it didn't make you sit down and think,
no.
rethink you're weak. That like it's not interesting.
Doesn't have value.
Listen, I beat that game and read those reviews and did not have the experience those people had. So like, I which is what by what I mean is like, you will probably like this game more than me. Most people. Most people will probably like this game more than me, but it did underscore this strange like tension for me, which is. I want to be the rah-rah story guy. I want to be the person who is like, and I am the person, do keep telling stories in games. We're going to get better at it. We're going to continue to find new tools. We're going to continue to find new grammars. We're going to tell incredible stories that do make me retreat into myself. But Edith Finch wasn't that for me, which and the difference between me and Bogost isn't that I think all stories and games are good. It's that I think they kind of suck too, but want us to fucking build a lot. Like, go build stuff. Do better. Like, don't.
Instead of giving up and saying, right. oh, whatever, this isn't the best thing, so give up on it. Be like, no, figure out ways to actually
right.
make
like,
things better.
I want the people
Work
who,
for it.
I want someone right now who's playing Edith Finch who walks away and goes like, that was fucking incredible, to then go make their own thing that will then, that thing is the thing that's going to get me.
Yes.
You know? So.
Yes. I have one thing. Oh,
yeah.
Go ahead. Rob, go ahead.
No, you.
I was going to say, I just want to read a brief part of this piece,
sure.
and I want to tell you why I take umbrage with it.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Let's go.
All right. He's talking about Gone Home. He's talking about basically what it did. Feats but relative ones. Writing about Gone Home upon its release, I called it the video game equivalent of young adult fiction. Hardly anything to be ashamed of, but maybe nothing to praise either. If the ultimate bar for meaning in games is set at teen fare, then perhaps they will remain stuck in a perpetual adolescence, even if they escape the stereotypical dude bro's basement. Other paths are possible, and perhaps the most promising ones will bypass, rather than resolve, games' youthful indiscretions. I got very mad when I read this piece. Again, agreeing that most games don't do linear story all mm-hmm. that well. I can think of a few, but I also hate the argument of like, oh, we hold up the same six games and say, well,
like,
the story in
BioShock.
This was great. Like, we don't have to do that. We don't have to go to reductive arguments like that. It's fine that there are some examples that prove, you know, the exceptions that prove the rule kind mm-hmm. of thing. That's okay. People are still figuring these things out. I'm okay with that process. What I take serious issue with is just the kind of vague whiff of sexism and like I know what's good.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like looking down on young adult fiction.
Right.
I just have a
fiction.
Problem with.
Well, then the thing
young
is,
adult fiction is, it, I'll just briefly finish this thought. But young adult fiction has become very much sort of code for stories about girls
right.
and women.
And that young women read. Right.
And the things that young women are concerned about are stupid and crappy and childish.
Which,
like this idea, this attitude.
And it's also
that.
An attitude that doesn't reflect the reality, which is that 55% of people who buy young adult fiction are adults.
Right.
Like that is the truth. That is the market for
works.
Young adult fiction is mostly adults, actually.
That's the longer version of the genre.
Yeah, young adult fiction. Open parentheses, mostly for adults.
Mostly for adults.
And the thing for me that bugs me, and I throw away line in the piece about this, which is like most people there. Yes, I bet that if Ian Bogost was at a dinner with someone who wrote young adult fiction, they would have a great conversation.
Sure,
he's someone who comes out of a literature program. Like that's what his PhD is in comparative literature. Like I bet he'd have an okay time there. I think he probably has it. I think in his heart of hearts, he probably understands what that field is like. But the people who read him, and I say the people, meaning me 10 years ago, will not get that whole bit of a little extra nuance. What they'll hear is. Fuck young adult fiction.
Yes.
I aspire to something greater. I'm going to tell the first true great American
Moby
video game
Dick
novel.
Moby Dick is the greatest novel ever written. I don't know why
exactly.
you try doing anything else.
I don't know. I do my best to be deeply aware of our role as a platform that reaches lots of people and encourage us to go hard on things that are worth going hard on and like really hit them when it's time to like be angry about it. I was pissed about We Are Chicago this year, and I think it's right to be pissed about that game. I also don't think the entire field of young adult fiction is as easy of a of a metaphor for why this other thing is bad as he thinks it is.
Right.
There's also a tendency in like I'm guilty of this as much as anyone else because I think like you know as a publication like we are on the side of like video games should tell better stories. We like storytelling in video games in all different forms. Right. There is also a tendency. Gone Home was not a victim. It benefited from this. Edith Finch will benefit from this. There is a tendency to hyperbolize and overly praise and turn a critical eye away from games that attempt to engage in more what feels like a more adult, mature style of storytelling that is beyond just Space Marine things because we have not encountered it before. So even as critics, we don't have the language to even critique it because we're blinded by the fact that this game tried to do this, right? So Gone Home is a game that's universally praised. And I liked it a lot too. But the fact that, like, you know, it tells a story about like the discovery of, you know, a young queer woman's sexuality and it's a first person mature storytelling, like, means most people don't want to critique that game with a 10-foot pole. And so, like, part of what's useful about what Bagos does here is, like, yes, he pokes the hornet's nest, but I think it forced, like, by us writing those stories, by us having this conversation, by us doing this podcast, like, it shores up, like, designers, critics' own arguments for, like, why is this worthwhile? Like, what aren't these things doing right? Like, what could they be doing better? Because I think we have a tendency to go, to give games like this credit for trying, and because we so desperately want more of this. And not necessarily always being as critical as we should, just because it's more of aspirational than it is necessarily a direct application.
Oh, it's tough because I think one of the things that we all talked about before we launched Waypoint was we took as a founding principle that games are art and that games are you know, a deeply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Important medium for our generation, and by that, we meant that we didn't want to have those fights anymore. Those fights are boring. If someone pitches me a story about, like, oh, well, this game proves that video games are art now and they deserve the protections of art, like, boring, done. No, we're not having that fight. If you have that fight, you've already lost. You're already framing this as a thing you could lose. Like, no, we are having the second step, which is like, okay, well, like, what works about Edith Finch? What works about Virginia? And now that we have Edith Finch, now that we have Virginia, now that we have the Firewatch, now that we have this whole, you know, era of walking simulator games, hopefully we're getting into the place where we can take scalpels to these things, can move past our excitement over the fact that they are telling stories that are not just Space Marine stories and begin to figure out what makes them tick and, like, what really works for us and what doesn't. Like,
absolutely.
For me, of the set of games that we've talked about that are in this kind of broad environmental storytelling thing, like, Gone Home is still my favorite of that set.
Yeah, same.
But, like, a weird thing is, like, I think I like Virginia, a game that I walked away from way more ambivalent than I think I walked away from Edith Finch in terms of pure craft. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Edith Finch is way above it in terms of, like, oh, wow, the mechanics here are really communicating something. I think I like Virginia more, and I'm happy to have that experience so I can kind of try to unpack what happened there.
Well, Virginia just, like, it bites off a lot. And, like, that's the, like, you know, I think a lot of people are going to like Edith Finch. I liked Edith Finch a lot. But also, in a lot of ways, it's, like, it's a little safer, and that's not meant to be a pejorative as much as, like, Virginia just bites off a lot narratively. And I think it fucks it up in the end. But, like, I'm so glad that we're at a point where we're getting a diversity of approaches so that you have some games that say, okay, we're just going to go for it. And maybe it's a miss, but they went for it in a way that's exciting because we're getting enough of these types of games that there's a space for games to try and be that ambitious and maybe misstep, but at least they want to step in one direction.
Right. Stories. Video games.
Stories.
Young adult fiction.
Yeah, YA.
it is, I think, a really...
It's a worthwhile debate to have, I think. Not debate. This isn't a debate. It's a worthwhile discussion.
The thing that fucking sucks is it's like the eighth time this debate has happened.
I know.
I've been in it twice.
I meant on our podcast, but yes.
I know. No. Oh, yeah, we're not.
Yeah.
I think we're all basically of the same mind, even if all of our tastes are a little different.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird thing to see it crop up again. It is disheartening sometimes. I know, like, everyone in this podcast has been in this game a long time from various angles, whether from pure journalism, from freelance review stuff, from academia. And these debates just keep happening. And I think part of what drives them forward is that every person in them tends to have a different understanding of what the status quo is. So, like, Rob, you are in the niche of the niche of the niche in terms of war games for the mainstream. I could expect someone who lives your situation to feel like everyone just cares about these, like, about dragons. Everyone just cares about sci-fi shit. Everyone just cares about linear stories and space marines and teen angst. And all of that goes over there. And I'm interested in resource counters. Do you ever feel like that? And could you ever imagine writing that screed that is like, the status quo doesn't have a place for what I think is good?
Years ago, I could imagine myself writing that screed. Years ago, I think it would have been really easy for me when I first, like, figured out how Europa Universalis 3 worked. And I just got, like, super, like, high and cranked up on that. Like, I could easily imagine myself sort of writing that, like, look at you silly people with your narratives. And then, you know, sort of praising to the sky, you know, these world simulations, these mechanics. Now I play a lot more. I've seen that version of game a million times, too. But the other thing is, the more I play, the more I like, and the more the borders between those experiences break down. Like, so the example I used a minute ago about the, you know, being the general on the Battle of Gettysburg, on the battlefield of Gettysburg, that is driven by systems. At the same time, there was a scenario designer sort of scripting that. Like, it was a semi-authored moment, but the effect, the thing I'm still doing in that game is exploring a space. Now, it's not a traditional narrative space. I'm not, like, opening cupboards and, like, you know, it's not necessarily environmental storytelling in the way that Bagost is sort of framing it, but at the same time, I just don't see the hard dichotomy anymore.
Right.
Like, I just don't, like, for me, I see there is a continuity between me playing that war game or me, like, trying to figure out what to do on the eve of World War II and Hearts of Iron, and then what I'm doing in a game like Gone Home. Like, I can see there is a commonality to that experience, expressed very differently, but I just don't completely get the value of the distinction. I think that's because you can get so reductive about this and how games function and how they express meaning and tell you stories about their worlds that eventually you end up, I think, in a really boring place, which is, well, why make anything? Why isn't this a documentary? And I don't find that the most exciting place to go, because for me, the reason you do it is in that act of exploration. It gives you the ability to step into worlds and stories that, in a way that you couldn't otherwise. And
imperfect though they may be.
Yeah.
Right.
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 Yeah, I think that the thing that I keep coming back to in all of this is being a realist about what people do, and, like, we, for whatever ridiculous reason, have all decided to be at a video game website and to play video games. That is the thing that pulls us, even when they're not necessarily the best. I played Edith Finch last night instead of watching Legion, and I hear Legion is dope.
It's pretty
good.
You
know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I played Edith Finch last night instead of, you know, re-listening to the Kendrick Lamar album or listening to the Mary J. Blige album that dropped. I'm going to listen to those things. I'm going to find time for those. But when I had, like, this little 2.5-hour chunk of time, I was like, I want to figure out what this thing is. And, like, that's just how people are. And I always would just rather start at that point and then figure out why we do the things we do and how to do them better than to try to make hard cuts. I'm also not writing for The Atlantic. I'm also not writing for an audience that doesn't understand what games – the state of play for that's, games.
That is also part of what makes it frustrating.
Yeah.
Sure. I would love for somebody who is a realist but also an advocate for trying, for making things better, for actually going on a limb creatively and doing something interesting, even if you do fail. I would rather that advocate, who also has the same like intellectual rigor as somebody like Ian Bogost, I would rather that person be writing that for that audience, if that makes sense.
And that, so the thing that is tricky there is like, does that feel like cheerleading then?
Well, that's why I said like, also a realist, fine. Like somebody who can say like, hey, you know what? A lot of this really does suck in a lot of ways.
Right.
And
maybe
like,
who also says, who doesn't necessarily make the young adult fiction comparison.
Right.
And
just who's not just fiction, dumping on something.
The fiction comparison, which is most books also suck.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Most
Thank
stories
you. Yes.
are bad. Like
it's
they're not
really hard to do any of this right in any medium.
Totally.
Like, and that's fine that most stuff sucks. Like that doesn't mean the world is going to come to an end.
Right.
It's definitely a process of finding creative, intelligent people who can work in whatever medium it is that they choose to make their work in, and that is worth something. That is valuable. And I'd rather see the value in that, and I'd rather see somebody who advocates for changing and trying than just throw the table.
Throw it out.
That's my take.
Anyway. Rob, can I make a hard pivot?
Please do.
I'm going to do, you know, I was going to try to find a segue here, but then I realized, like, you know who doesn't do fucking segues? Vikings. They kick the door down. They demand.
No
they
segues.
Demand what they are. I want to raid. I want to raid right now.
No segue, Erickson.
I'm here to burn this place down and get stories about Vikings. Tell me about Expeditions Vikings.
I don't understand why a game about Viking expeditions even has to tell a story, to be honest. Expeditions Vikings is a follow-up to Expeditions Conquistador, a very cool tactics RPG that I did not play, but Troy Goodfellow, my colleague on Three Moves Ahead, said, you definitely need to play this. We need to do a show on that. And I was like, we definitely will. Anyway, point is, here's Expeditions Vikings. And so far, it's pretty cool. My play session this morning was cut short by a hard crash, which was not great. Oh, very dramatic point.
Bad.
But the cool thing that's going on here is that it is very much like... It is a squad tactics RPG, a little bit XCOM, a little bit Baldur's Gate.
Okay.
But it's about you as a young Viking thane taking over from your disastrously unsuccessful father. And right from the first, like, it's about shoring up these clan relationships within the family and with neighboring clans and trying to figure out, like, what does leadership mean to you, right? Are you going to sort of fit the classic mold of, I'm the thane, I'm the leader because I can kick all your asses, basically? Are you going to make the case for yourself that you should be thane because you're the only person here with the strategic vision, like, necessary to sort of lead the clan back to glory? And so it's kind of a cool thing where in between, like, even before you get to the battles, there are a lot of systems in place to drive these relationships, to open up options that might not be open to you if you were just sort of your standard Viking berserker character. So it was really neat. Right in the opening, like, the first thing you do basically is work the room at your father's funeral feast and decide how you're going to deal with an early challenge to your reign from some disaffected clansmen. And then you have to deal with a far more significant threat, which is your uncle is going to be making a play for the title and control of the clan. And he's going to kick your ass. And so how are you going to get out of this, right? Are you going
How
to,
did you get out of it?
So I maybe was less honorable than I could have been. Okay, so here's the thing. Before you do anything, you create your character, and a lot of this game is going to be driven by combat, but there's also a lot of, like, conversation and adventuring that happens outside of combat. So
okay. So there's, like, a story on top of all of the systems.
Yeah.
Scripted. Okay. Linear. Okay.
Yeah. Very, very traditional RPG in some ways. And I went all in on perception and sense. And perception in this one is basically, it makes you good with ranged weapons and also lets you, like, spot traps. And sense, I think, was very much about, like, diplomacy and, like, talking to people and being empathetic.
Okay.
I didn't really do much with endurance. I might have, like, every time I wanted a few more points in an attribute, I was like, maybe I could be a little less enduring. And my description kept getting, like, less impressive, where it was like, you are a young and strong Viking, keen and ready to step up into his father's role. By the end, it was like, you're very smart, wise Viking. Everyone says you're really smart. Your health's a little frail. You're a little concerned, but you'll be fine. You know the inside of a
Viking cabin better than anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
You know all of the great stories, all of the songs.
You're a big song person.
You know them all.
I mean, all your great Viking stories are about the guy who, like, was too sick to leave his ship. That's why he was always on the ship, right? Like, you sail the seas and you stay on the boat.
Stay on the ship.
Right.
Anyway, so basically what I did was I spent the night before laying a bunch of traps and having my uncle lightly poisoned so that he'd
be sick
for the brawl. And then I laid a trap. And right when I was about to sort of deliver the coup de grace and I think win the fight, the game hard crashed desktop. So gonna have to do it all again. But I really did enjoy the combination of pretty decent tactics game, but also a lot of like Dark Ages politics. There's a little bit of like Crusader Kings, a little bit of like the Last Kingdom in this game that in a way that I'm really, really digging.
Awesome.
Nice.
That sounds okay. If I had time for Vikings, I might check that out.
I think it's an Austin game. I think it might actually be a Danielle game too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool characters in this one, including the fact that you're like your biggest badass friend is what's her name? Like this one named Nea. Or something like that.
She's actually pounding on the building right now. Nea is definitely, she's getting strong. It's how she like works out.
Yeah.
That sounds really rad. I'm into that.
Yeah, she's the character who's constantly like, no, let me fight that guy for you. And I was like, I don't know if that looks good. And she's like, it'll look great. I'll kick that guy's ass.
Trust.
I'll make it look great, honey.
Yeah. Boom. I got this.
Yeah.
Speaking of Danielle-style games, Danielle played games this week.
I played a game that wasn't even Breath of the Wild, even though I played more Breath of the Wild, and it is called Pinstripe. So the thing that's really cool about Pinstripe, let me paint you
a
picture.
You're a mobster.
Let me paint you
a pinstripe suit.
It's so much weirder than that.
Oh, okay, sure.
You are an ex-priest named Ted. You have this cute little daughter named Bo. It's a 2D game. It's sort of an adventure platformer. It's like the cave. It's a little bit like Night in the Woods, but a little more puzzly than something like Night in the Woods. But you're definitely running and jumping on things. Like, it's not like, you're not like inventory management, you know, juggling
that. It's like a platformer.
It's kind of like a platformer, but it's very much like an adventure game.
Okay.
You're going to get a thing, and that'll kind of bring you to the next screen, that sort of thing.
Wait, you're an ex-priest with a daughter.
Yes.
How do you think you became an ex, Austin?
Maybe you're not a priest. You're some kind, you're wearing, there's a cross.
Okay.
Maybe you're like,
I guess,
a,
I don't know what denomination.
Maybe you're like a vicar.
Yeah,
I don't know. You're something.
Totally.
You're some clergyman. Totally. And an evil, terrifying guy named Mr. Pinstripe kidnaps your daughter, brings her to hell, and you have to go through hell, frozen hell mostly, but I think there might be some fiery parts. I'm not quite done with it.
Okay.
I played like 90 minutes or so, which I think is most of the game. It's probably going to be like a 4-hour game or so. I guess that's not most, but a good chunk.
I played
through a good chunk of hell yesterday. Let me just say that. It's just really well designed. It's really beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It's really, really beautiful.
Describe what this looks like a little bit, because
it's very sort of painterly, and I would call it, I guess we already kind of used the Tim Burton thing, but it is very, like, early, like, 90s Tim Burton, like, the soft edges, the sort of, that sort of very expressive animation.
There's some gory here.
Very, very
Not
gory. Yeah. Edward Gorey.
Edward Gorey.
Edward Gorey, yeah. It's
a lot of good sounds this week.
You gotta get a good one in there. The thing that's really cool about this game, not only is it very well designed, the puzzle solving is pretty light, but it always feels clever, which is a very, very difficult bar to sort of hit, I think. You know, to make puzzles that like are pretty breezy, but you're never just like, oh, whatever, I'm just going to click on the thing and the thing will happen. You actually have to think a little bit.
But like just enough so that you get like a little spark.
Like, I'm so smart. You know, that little that little feeling, which I love.
Mr. Pinstripe, you asshole.
Yeah, Mr. Asshole. Mr. Asshole, that's his real name. Asshole. Asshole McPinstripe.
Wow.
Full name. One of the coolest things about this game is that it was actually designed by one person.
And awesome.
Drawn, music composed by, designed by, I'm sure somebody else did something, but it's largely the work of one person. And typically when something is made by one person, I love games that are very personal and made by, you know, like a tiny team or like a one person development studio. I love like Kitty Horror Show. I love...
Right.
You know, creators like that.
There's an even
often,
though they suck looming over the set.
No, not even a little. It's just more that I will be willing to forgive things like a lack of polish or like a very, very limited scope and something like that because it makes logical sense. One person did all of the things here. It's okay if it's not as a Horizon Zero Dawn kind of situation. But this is incredibly polished and really, really beautiful and very fully, like, it feels like a very full, coherent, full game, not just a sort of vignette, which impressed me quite a bit.
Awesome. So. People should check that out. So briefly, I just want to do a thing, which is, like, the games we talked about today so far. What Remains of Edith Finch? Expeditions Vikings. Pinstripe.
Gone Home.
Gone Home. Briefly. That's the one with the cupboards. If you were like, what was that game they talk about with cabinets? You opened up cabinets, Gone Home.
You drank a cabinet.
The game with a bunch of highly realistic X-Files VHS tapes.
True.
Correct.
That game's pretty good. All right, let's take a quick dip in the old question bucket.
Yeah. It's
breezy this week, but if you have a question, you can send it to the question bucket. You can put it in. Send it to gamingadvice.com. Use the subject question. We are going to try to empty out this question bucket at some point. We should clean it out a little bit. There's some good questions.
There's
in there
a good third of it that needs to kind
of. About a third of it, maybe a half of it we'll get rid of and filter in a bunch of new stuff.
Yeah.
We also, as always, read new questions on Monday. We dip into the question bucket on Friday. We read new stuff on Mondays. But since it's Friday, I'm going to need a number from 1 till 120. Who's got one? Rob, I can see you.
Yeah, he looked very pensive.
Looking for a number.
Oh. 104.
Oh, definitely 104. Look at that.
That's a great number.
That's a pretty good number. Yeah. I hope we'll find out. All right. We answered this question already.
Good.
Because it's about Thanksgiving. It's about how to survive Thanksgiving.
Yep.
Good.
And that means there's a new 104.
Poison.
New 104.
Okay. All right. This is interesting. And I'm glad you're here for this, Rob. So this comes in from Garrick in Vancouver. I think that's how you pronounce this name, G-U-E-R-R-I-C.
Yeah.
Hey, Wayfarers. I heard you were looking for questions about politics and games. So while not specifically political, I wanted to ask you about the interaction between American games media and non-American games. I want to specifically ask about Western games from outside of the U.S., since they seem more likely to be discussed without reference to their country of origin. For instance, Japanese or Korean games. Like, you know, we play Persona 5 and we go, oh, it's a Japanese game.
We even call it like a JRPG.
Right, but sometimes we're like, oh, yeah, this is from Europe. Shrug. America. Us. That's how we do. While many prominent Anglophone video game media outlets are run and staffed by Americans, many of the Western games that garner a lot of discussion in those outlets are made outside of the U.S. by people living in either other Anglophone countries like Canada and the U.K. Or in non-Anglophone countries like Germany, Poland, France, Sweden, or Ukraine. These countries all have different social histories and political cultures, and it seems fair to think that this might influence the content and nature of the games that they create. On the flip side, many of these developers know that the U.S. is the largest single Western consumer of video games and hub of games media, and as such, they work to tailor their games to American audiences, or at least what they think or imagine what American audiences might be. But even in doing so, they are inextricably creating from their position within their own country's social and political cultures. This leads me to my pair of questions. How do you as American journalists and critics approach discussing games that have been developed by people who live outside the political and cultural landscape of the U.S.? And what are your thoughts on the ways that non-American games developers choose to approach American audiences or not, and the impact that these decisions have both on games and gaming media? All the best, Garrick. from Vancouver?
Good deep question in that question
Very
bucket right
deep
there.
Question in the question bucket.
Exhale.
There. Deep breaths.
Well, first thing I'll say is just it is important, I think, to consider that context, of course. Yeah. You know, we do a little bit, I feel like, you know, we talk about Witcher 3, we're always talking about like, oh, you know, this game is from Polish developer, you know, CD Projekt Red, that kind of thing. And it can't be ignored, absolutely. Like, it's important to consider where any creator is coming from. Not just physically, obviously, but what all that goes into.
I do think... And this might be a gross generalization, and boy, good things always follow statements like this might be a gross generalization.
Proceed, Rob. Please proceed.
This ain't
So anyway, I think games like The Witcher. So years and years ago, I see it less now, but like in the mid 2000s, it definitely seemed like there was this really distinctive Eastern European contingent of games that were making games that felt way more grounded in other cultural contexts and other referent objects that they were sort of playing off of. The Witcher is an obvious example because it's sort of playing into a novel series that I don't think a lot of people had encountered. But it also gave us games like Stalker, games like Metro, which are really about like the like post-Soviet order or lack thereof. And to me, it felt like a lot of those games were specific in a way that a lot of like games from Western Europe did not feel specific. They felt a little more tailored to a broader Anglophone world in a way that a lot of the games that I enjoyed in the mid-2000s from Eastern Europe did not. And that might just be because a lot of the more specific games from Western Europe didn't really find much traction. Like
you weren't like a big fan of like the Froggy Wares Sherlock Holmes games. That wasn't your big Western Europe.
But those are interesting games, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And well, they're interesting. They're interesting too. Sorry, not Froggy Wares. Just Frog Wares.
Just
Apologies.
Frog.
Is that a Romanian studio?
I think so. Maybe? I don't know enough.
But that's interesting, like, you know,
it's... Ukrainian, actually. Actually Ukrainian, apparently.
Okay so
here we are
so
again.
So this implies...
Wonder why you got Western European out of that studio name
Frogwares. I don't know. What shitty thing did I do today? Add it to the fucking list.
No, so, like... But I don't know. Like, does anyone sort of, like... have that feeling that a lot of games that are being made from major studios in the UK, in France, in Germany, aren't necessarily as specific to country
of
origin?
They're owned by American companies a lot of the time.
Ubisoft is the big one that is
right.
Not,
well, that's
right?
What I'm
and
thinking.
And then I think,
of.
But the thing is, like with Ubisoft, I think you look at Rayman, you look at Raving Rabbids, and I actually think that is a very like French cartoon aesthetic and sense of humor, and so I think that's one example where I did see that.
And that's what makes the Assassin's Creed games so fascinating, because Assassin's Creed 3, which I wish was a better game than it actually ended up being, but it was like here's a French company doing like a take on the American Revolution, which is fascinating in and of itself. That stuff is interesting if you like know of the historical sort of background of these game developers, and like part of the reason I like the Metro games is because they are specific, right? Like that's I like the fact that I feel alien playing them because my own perspective has no grounding in a lot of like the social and political constructs that are probably deeply familiar to, you know, folks from that region. Like, you know, they can pick up on things that I don't, but being an alien to that those cultures and those structures is part of why I find those games fascinating.
Totally. I think that there might be a line that you could – we were actually just in a pitch meeting where we were having a similar conversation. Someone had pitched us a story about a region that they saw having a sort of renaissance of game developers. But they didn't really – in that pitch – and I'm not trying to drag the person who pitched this at all. When we get pitches like this about like, oh, the scene of game developers in X country or region or city or whatever a lot. But they didn't necessarily pitch what the through line was of like – the games that came out of this place all have this thing in common, or there is some overlap in design ethos or convention or something. But I do, now that I'm like looking at who came from where and what different countries produced games in the last decade, I can see certain sorts of, like, you look at the games that came out of Germany, for instance, in the last decade. One of the biggest ones is like the Farm Simulator, and like in general that sort of like
very technical, very detail-oriented.
Infrastructural.
Yeah.
Interested in the mechanics of mundane life from a country that has a much different relationship to infrastructure and logistics than what we have in America. There might be something there. But even like the stuff that comes out of the Deep Silvers of the world.
Yeah.
Which are like the X series of space simulators, the Gothic series of games, like the kind of computer RPGs that are really fiddly and really like they have lots of inventory management, and they have lots of like a bunch of different stat systems, and many of them come out of German only tabletop role playing games,
like Daedalic or something like that too, totally. Like the adventure games that come from that region.
You're right, totally. Yeah. There's that whole adventure game, like the kind of German adventure game heritage there. I think a lot of it just didn't translate to us or wasn't marketed to us in that way. When you go back and look at some of the marketing around games like Stalker and Metro and The Witcher, there's a lot of like, this comes from a place. This comes from a very specific heritage that is a little exoticized for you as an American. That you're a little bit like, ooh, you're getting this is what the people from that place really feel, and like this reflects their specific heritage. And that was also true. It happens to be true that people in Eastern Europe made those games, and that's rad. And like, I'm thrilled that they got a wider audience. But there is like definitely a bit of that, like in the marketing around those games, that and in the kind of conversations at shows and stuff like that, that is about trying to appeal to the Western audience, not by playing up that stuff.
It's more offering something different,
right?
You know?
Exactly.
Oh, you're a little sick of this. Well, let me show you this other perspective that was shown in this game.
Whereas no one came to me with Two Worlds 2 and was like, "This is a clear representation of continental European fantasy." You know, like
sure.
This has
continental fantasy.
Mm, oh,
I see.
Is that like a continental breakfast?
It's very similar. Yeah, I think that's a tough thing. And then I guess as a journalist, it's tough because I am very interested in developers who come from places that we don't traditionally think about development. And also I'm interested in playing games that I like. And that can sometimes be – this comes back to that question that we've all talked about of like, okay, is it the fact that it's one developer? Do we go a little lighter on this? Do we have a better time with it because we know that there's only one person behind it? If this is doing something new and unique, Patrick, like Gone Home felt like it was doing for us, do we ease up on the break? And it's not even a conscious decision. It's not like, to be clear, when I look back and feel like, okay, well, maybe I went easy on Romance of the Three Kingdoms 12. It was just because I hadn't played a Romance of the Three Kingdoms game in a while.
Right.
We sometimes make those things and later can look back at it and be like, or when I said, like, oh, Grow Home was an incredible game, like, part of it was just like, wow, Ubisoft. Yeah.
That game was so good. Stop that.
That game's great. That game's great. I loved that game. I haven't gone back to it. I'm afraid. What if I go back to it and I'm like, it was fine?
It's still good.
Is it? Have you gone back?
I did, because I played Grow Home 2, and Grow Home 2 didn't work, but Grow Home is still a small, experimental, really great game.
We'll see.
Okay. Somebody in chat brought up Beat Cop, which...
Yeah, that just came out recently and is, unless I'm thinking of a different game than Beat Cop, maybe I am, there are a lot of police simulations that have come out recently.
Yeah.
Often about American-style police that are made from developers who are not from America.
Yeah. I've missed this movement entirely. What, like... Police quests? That sounds interesting.
So Beat Cop is very specifically very police quest.
It's about 80s cop American 80s cop shows.
You know
that
what?
Is, like,
yeah.
the most... Mm. That's
there
what they say
of,
they're evoking
There were not
the
a lot of actual ethnic slurs in 80s American cop shows, though. And there
sure.
are in Beat Cop.
Sure,
so
I got you.
There is, like, a little
that's
bit of,
That's how they're
like,
advertising it.
Yeah, I know how they're advertising
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
I'm just saying,
gotcha.
That doesn't sound promising.
Did you play much Beat Cop?
No, I've just watched some of
okay,
it.
Okay, gotcha.
But, like, that is definitely an interesting thing, too, for me, is, like, when a developer from outside of the States wants to appeal to that audience, and then develops a game with that in mind, and like tries to have American references. That does happen with international all around the world, yeah. And sometimes it's just because they like it. Like I think about Deadly Premonition as being a love letter to a certain type of American media,
sure,
and like. Yeah, that's okay. That's a vision of America. Sure, like yeah.
You know it is.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on this? As someone who covers, you know, games from Europe, Rob.
What question shall we fly to next? I'm just gonna keep channeling Continental Breakfast.
Oh, there. Oh, you cut out. He's out. Like, what? He's like, let's take the next question. That was his. That's yeah. what he said.
That's
so
fair.
There's
fair.
150 of these things. We gotta do right by our listeners.
Well, it's 150 of these, and also it's 1:40 p.m. and I have to eat lunch between now and my 2 p.m. meeting.
Yeah, so we've gone over an hour. We should probably.
We've gone. This has been a long one. So
I feel like we covered a lot of good ground.
We covered a lot of ground, you know? In general. It's hot in here.
It is a little hot.
The spring. Has snuck into summer into this room.
It's going to be 80 today.
I hope whoever that is drilling into the ground doesn't strike summer.
It was Nadra or Neha.
I don't
Sorry.
Know what that Viking's name is.
I probably got it wrong.
Look.
Listen, some of my best friends are Vikings. I agree.
Some are your best friends. I understand.
That's going to do it for us this week. I have been Austin Walker, your host and MC of Waypoint Radio. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Rob, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter.com at Rob Zachney.
Oh.
Patrick, what about you?
You can find me at Patrick Klubik.
Danielle Riendo.
Danielle R.I. on Twitter.com.
You can find everything we do at waypoint.vice.com, on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, on Facebook at facebook.com/waypointvice. We did a stream the other day with Weird Twitter's own Leon. L-E-Y-A-W-N. You might know him as the Twitter person who makes dope music.
Can we see those?
And also is a cute little fat bird on Twitter.
Okay.
And we debuted a song of his over on our Facebook, so go check that out. We're also going to do a full debut of his new album of music. Slash, it's like an OST for a fictional like SNES game.
Yeah, a fictional game about birds.
Featuring the characters behind us if you're watching the stream.
Those people.
On Sunday, I think. So look for that. What else do we have going on? I think that we might do a stream later.
Might
if we
doing
have time.
Some streaming today.
We did some streams over the week. Those will be up at youtube.com/waypointvice and at waypoint.vice.com. Just click on the videos. There's a little bar in the top left.
You say click on.
It's called a hamburger. Did you know that? The thing in the top left of a website that is like three bars. Like you click on it.
Oh,
like a
because
menu
it's
expands.
bun and. And meat.
Yeah, red meat in the middle. Or not meat. Whatever.
For me,
protein.
It would be a veggie.
I don't know. Right, exactly.
Veggie burger.
It could be a veggie burger. And if it's nine things, if it's like a dot, if it's nine dots, that's called a waffle.
That's called a waffle?
Because it looks like the nooks of a waffle.
Oh,
that's like
I see.
Behind the scenes, right? You pull back the curtain a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Bit
curtain is all the way back now.
That's going to do it for us this week. Thanks to Bowen for letting us use his song Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Thanks to Tim Barnes, TimBarnes451 on Twitter.
Tim Barnes.
Thanks to Dylan Coburn, who doesn't use Twitter because he's too cool for Twitter. He's smiling right now. his finger is hovering over the button to take us to the end card, which means it's time for me to ask Danielle one thing. What is it that we say at the end of the week?
Be good at it.
Peace.